RSN 927 Summer Breakfast.
Hey, Sto, welcome back.
Morning, Maisie. Morning, everyone. It's good to be back.
We had to get you back.
Jeez, because there's been a lot happening.
Well,
so much cricket.
There's been a lot happening, but there's been a lot of tension in the ranks here at RSN 927 surrounding the early mail.
Yes.
Yeah, your voice was on the promo. And I love your voice, Hester, but it was on for too long.
Yeah, no, I'm trying to get back on. I just want to try and just hold it for a little bit longer, Maisie. So I'll try and find a winner for us
We had you for about a week, I reckon, and then Cusey jumped in for one day and stole the limelight, and he held it till last Friday. And finally, we got another winner with Glenn McFarlane.
Oh, but I love it. We'll try and find another one this morning.
I reckon Macca's about one from nine.
He's not a great
You're
punter.
You're one from
he?
One.
He's not a great punter. Let's be honest.
It has been a bit of a lean trot for the RSN family out there in terms of the early mail, but that's why we got you back.
Yep.
We'll be seeing you every Wednesday over the next couple of weeks. So
a bit of an injection of form.
Fingers crossed. Now, I struggled to get up this morning for a couple of reasons.
Yes.
Social sport, when do you have to retire?
What have you done?
Well, I was playing touch footy last night, dive for a try.
No.
And I've never done a groin before, but just sort of tweak something in there.
That's no good.
And you're no good at all.
No, social sport. To be honest.
Do you play any?
No, I'm not sure that I'm ever going to make a comeback at anything, to be honest. A bit of golf, that's all I've got in me.
Yep.
The groin, you've gone.
Yeah. Never done a groin before.
You do not want to ping a groin. That's just it's not a great area.
We play at Faulkner Park,
right,
and it gets a bit too serious for Z grade or whatever we're in, and we're all old now.
So it's a genuine touch rugby sort of setup.
Yeah. And then last year, the sniper got me from about level 8 of one of the apartments overlooking Faulkner Park, and the hammy just went ping. That was the first hammy I'd ever done, so that was gone.
Touch wood. I've never done a soft tissue. So
haven't you?
No, I've been close a couple of times, just maybe a little tiny one, but never a big one. So I wouldn't know what it's like.
Really?
No.
That's unbelievable.
Well, maybe I have to play a little bit more social sport.
Exactly. That's where all the old guys turn up at all. Everyone walks in sore. Half pinged his calf last year in the
I remember
celebrity
that.
Game.
He's done a couple of hammies as well, hasn't he, Half?
Yep. No, it's not good. But
no.
I'm not thinking about retirement yet, but it was suggested a couple of times last night, unfortunately, and suggested by my wife when I got home a little bit too late. So, yes, it's a bit of a struggle this morning. And then my little man decided to learn how to roll over.
Oh, no.
Which was fantastic. At 2:30 a.m. in the
morning. Oh, no.
And unfortunately, when you roll over and you don't know how to get yourself off your belly...
There's trouble.
He was stuck.
Tears.
Yep, there were tears.
Oh, no.
So I watched a bit of the Socceroos game live, actually.
Straight up. So you've been on, haven't you?
I have,
Early mornings.
It's been a very long night. Very long night. So anyway, do you, in terms of your pre-season camp, it's funny you said you never got a soft tissue injury.
No.
In terms of your pre-season camps and all that sort of stuff, did you ever get pushed to the limit there where you thought you might an injury or hill runs or sand runs or whatever you do?
Absolutely. I've had my fair share of injuries, don't get me wrong, but it was there was one training session pre-season where I popped my shoulder out. So it wasn't classed as a soft tissue, but it was a season ending one.
Serious?
So it was a serious one. Just diving for a catch, pretty innocuous.
Yeah.
And a training drill, as we've seen Tommy Mitchell. That ripped the heart out of the Hawthorn Footy Club, definitely, and all the supporters. I was one of those. Don't worry about that.
But
pre-season, I never really had any dramas with any soft tissue or anything, really. So I was kind of lucky in that regard. But mine were more sort of chronic. So you'd get through a season, you'd need a little clean-up here or there on your ankle or your shoulder or something like that. But touch wood, I don't know. I don't think I moved fast enough to get any soft tissue injuries. I just couldn't.
You won't be running on the golf course. So
no, I won't be running on the golf.
You're all clear.
I'm all sweet.
You're all good.
Yeah.
No running. What about running between the wickets? Ever?
No, nothing.
Jeez, that's good.
No, I've been really lucky. As I said, I don't really try to sort of hit a few more boundaries than run the quick single. I think the only time I was probably under threat was the one and only test match. Dale Steyn and Mornay Morkel were at the height of their powers and they were bowling a few bounces. I desperately didn't want to have a duck in my first test. So pushed one straight into cover, Faf du Plessis ran around, and I dived, end up doing jarring my back. But that's as close as I've ever come, so I've been very lucky.
Did you find the pre-seasons got harder and harder?
Because
a lot of the footy players at this time of year say, oh, no, it's actually a bit easier now. We get more of a break now that I'm conditioned and I'm older. But cricket's a bit different where you've gone through this whole revolution of fitness over the last 20 years in your career. That must be a huge change.
When I first started, it was just a beep test at the start of the year and you go, okay, that's all right. You get to sort of level 12 or 13 and just sit down and just watch a couple of the other fitter younger boys go at it. But the reason why I went over to England was to get out of pre-season. I'd much rather be playing games and just having a couple of quiet pints over in England, rolling the arm over, rather than running around the Collingwood track out over in Gosh's paddock or something like that. So it was harder and harder. And the professionalism, every year there was something different. To the point now where they do, in cricket, they do 3 2K time trials a year. So they've got to do one at the start of the year, then they go before Big Bash and after Big Bash, because blokes would, a few years ago, blokes would go away from Big Bash and have a good time. If you're sitting on the pine and just enjoying yourself a little bit, you'd come back 5 or 6 kilos heavier and the S&Cs would be up in arms. So now afterwards, after the Big Bash, they come in and do a few more 2K time trials. So it's incredible.
That is amazing.
Yeah.
When do you run 2Ks in... when do you actually run continuously 2Ks in cricket?
Well, that was my big... It doesn't help your outswinger, does it?
No, that
was my biggest beef with some of the S&Cs. How is this 2 kilometre time trial going to help my outswinger or my leg cutter? It's not. So why are we doing it?
That's a fair point by you. In fact, I was listening last night to the cricket on the way home, and I think it was... Was it Rayudu who failed the yo-yo test after the IPL? And so he's one of the best players in the IPL last year, failed the yo-yo test and couldn't get back in the team.
It's extraordinary. That's what I mean. The professionalism in cricket has just gone through the roof, but the yo-yo test isn't that hard. The level you've got to get to is only 16. It's not that hard.
I thought the yo-yo test was tough.
No, it's not that bad.
Better than the beep test then.
To try and get an elite sort of score, it's quite hard. But to get the baseline that you need for cricket, I think it's about 16.5 or something like that.
What's the difference between the yo-yo test and the beep test?
The beep test is sort of almost continuous.
Yeah.
Whereas you get a 5-second break at the end of every sprint. So you get up and back, and then you've got this cone. You sort of go around to the cone, touch it, and then come back. And you've got about a 5-second break. So you get a little bit of a breather.
Yeah,
moving forward, but the beep test is a bit more continuous. So the yo-yos stop, start, sprint, then have a break, a bit more relevant to cricket, whereas if you're sort of chasing a ball in the outfield, you come back and then you got another ball, then you go and do another one, so it's repeat efforts.
Yep.
But that's extraordinary. You must have just overindulged, and I've done that in the IPL as well. It's just a few too many butter chickens. Don't worry about that.
How is the food over there?
Are
you
a curry man? It's gotten a lot. I'm not over there. They're way too hot for me. But
even the cool ones are hot there, are they?
You go less spice and it's still 15 chilies in there. It's not ideal. It is not ideal. It's hard because you sort of have to train really hard over there because it's all burgers and the fried stuff that you get in hotels. So there's no sort of... You sort of tend to steer away from the salads and things over in India.
I'm enjoying Chris Gayle on Instagram at the moment. It's sort of giving us a rundown of his diet every night. He's just eating...
What is it, vodka and...
there's a lot of that going on.
Yeah.
But it's basically alcoholic drinks and steak and veg.
Oh.
And he orders these steaks. He had an 800-gram steak the other night, Big Chris Gayle. Absolutely demolished it.
He's a monster.
But he posts all of his food and everything on his Instagram.
Well, speaking of star power, I'd love to see him over in the Big Bash. He's not doing much. No. He's just eating and drinking his way around the world at the moment.
That's right.
Imagine him at the top order for the Renegades.
It's funny you mentioned that.
Yes.
So the Big Bash this year, we're a little over halfway through the season.
Yep.
Feels like there's about 2 games to go.
There's about another seven rounds. Years to go.
Yeah,
it's incredible.
Exactly.
My wife is absolutely at the end of her tether. She's gone, John, what is... Because I've now been covering a few games and being a little bit in the media, I've got to be across the Big Bash and the One Day Internationals and the Test. She goes, You have sat there for 16 hours straight and watched the test match into the Big Bash. She goes, I've had enough. That's it. No more. So she's had enough.
Yesterday was off the charts because the One Day International started early and then I was flicking all channels. We had the tennis going on all day. So at my house, the tennis goes on at 11 o'clock and then the TV doesn't go off until about 10:30 at night. The little man woke up and I turned it back on with the Socceroos. So I reckon my TV was on for about 18 hours.
But now there's all the laptops and there's the streaming, so you can literally sit there and watch six or seven different sports. It's incredible.
Yeah, yeah. Are you sick of planes? You've been flying around a lot to Big Bash.
More than when we played. When I played, but yeah, it's incredible the level of cricket or the amount of cricket going on around the country. It's starting to. A few more weeks and then you can just put the feed up for a couple. So I'm looking forward to it.
The hardest thing this year, too, has been the fact that with our partners, they don't really understand that the Big Bash has been added to in terms of the fixture.
No, they think, when's the final?
Yeah.
When's the final? Eight games
next
down.
Week.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is a concern. It's
still another 7 years to go. So
that's right. And still got another test, couple of tests as well.
Yeah, I know.
Which
long
is fantastic.
Summer.
It is a very long summer, but I have enjoyed it. It's been funny. It's been a funny summer because I've enjoyed it from the point of view that we haven't been the dominant selves that we usually are. And there's been a lot of self-reflection, a lot of controversy, a lot of selection dilemma and debate. But I actually think that's been healthy for the game.
It is, yeah.
But I'm not sure it's been healthy for us investing in the team. I think there's been a lot of educated discussion about it, probably more than previous years where we just demolished teams and that was that. But I think it has been an interesting summer from that regard.
That's what can happen when you're winning, isn't it? A lot can
Everything.
Get papered over. There's
Correct.
A lot of cracks and you just sort of just paper over the cracks a little bit and move on. And these sort of background things just bubble away and stuff tends to happen. And I think for the last 5 years, we've been, by and large, reasonably good. Last 12 to 18 months, not so much.
Yep.
And with the events of what happened and the media scrutiny that's placed on the team now, geez, there's a lot of discussion, a lot of debate. But I'm with you, Maisie. I think it's been healthy and it's been what Australian cricket's needed. And hopefully from all the review processes and listening to a few of the senior voices in Australian cricket, if we can just take a little bit of that on board, and I know Kevin Roberts is trying to do that, and I think it's going to be good. In the long run, it's going to be good for us, but we just need to get through the next little bit with a few wins. Well, not even just a few wins, just show us a little bit of mental toughness and show us a bit of application and get out there and play the Aussie way, and then that'll get everyone back on board.
Yeah, I think even last night, so in case you missed it, the Aussies went down last night with four balls remaining. MS Dhoni and Virat Kohli, unbelievable, in the run chase for India after the Aussies made 9 for 298. It looked like we were going to have a few more on the board, but a couple of wickets we lost late and collapsed towards the end after Marsh and Maxwell both went out. But amazing chase by Virat Kohli and MS Dhoni. Time to talk tennis with Craig Gabriel, who, tell you what, you must be tired after 3 days heading into day three, because it is a long time. I spent all day yesterday watching the tennis, about 16 hours.
You didn't come and visit?
No, I watched it from home in the air conditioning. It was a bit hot to me out there. I don't know how these people sit in the sun all day and watch tennis. Melt sitting on their seats. They get up and the seat had come with them. It was stifling at times yesterday, but probably not as hot as it could have been. Only 26 today, which is good news for the players. Let's start with Nick Kyrgios last night. What did you take out of the straight sets loss?
Yeah, there were opportunities for Nick in that match. First set was tight, then that second set, he had a situation where maybe he could have slipped ahead. The knee was troubling him. And the physio was out there once, taping it out. It looked like a heavy taping, and then Nick's ripping that off later on. He, as he put it, and you could see it, the way Milos played. Milos went into that match knowing that this was going to be a dicey situation with the crowd, knowing what it was, who he had across the net, and he went out all guns blazing and played an outstanding match. Sure. 30 aces. I think the 30th ace was on match point.
Yes, and one double. 30 and one.
That's wicked. That is wicked. Nick only had 15. So normally he'll have a massive number of aces, but Raonic played outstandingly well, really did.
The standard that Raonic played at last night was that sort of quarterfinal standard.
It's interesting on your side, Andrew, because that particular point was put to Kyrgios, and he sort of hedged a bit. He said, yeah, he played incredibly well, but he said there are a lot of players at that top level. I guess you're talking about the likes of a Federer or Djokovic, that capacity would still get on top of Raonic.
Okay. Nick Kyrgios, was this a lesson for him that if he doesn't put in a preseason like others do, that he'll never make it deep in the second week? Do you think he'll learn a bit from this Australian Open? First time he's ever gone out
in the first round. Yeah. It's his earliest exit at the Australian Open, which is very disappointing in particular. I think it's more a case of he needs to get his ranking up. I don't think it's just the off-season. I think he needs to be he has to have consistent results through the year to maintain a ranking up there that's going to give him a seeding. I think it was more that fact. And the danger of running into a name at the first couple of rounds was more the issue.
Do you think he should be aiming for this deep in the second week, though?
Oh yeah, absolutely. He should be aiming for that.
So where do you think he thinks he's at the moment?
Well, getting the runs of the board, getting that consistency going, being able to play without any sort of injuries and being physically fit to be able to move around on the court to counteract some of these serves. If you're hampered by a knee situation and you feel you haven't got that extra step, that's going to cause problems.
Well, it's a strange one, isn't it? Because for me, Nick Kyrgios has all the makings of a top 10 tennis player.
Well, Johnny Mack said he's the most talented player he's seen in the last decade.
That's right. And it just comes back to no preseason. He's already come out and said that he doesn't want to play too much throughout the year. Well, he's in a bit of a world of pain for me.
In professional sport, John, and you've been a professional cricketer for 15 years, were there ever players who lacked motivation who turned it around at some stage when they were 22, 23, or had the lesson been learned earlier?
Yeah, I think you learn some hard lessons along the journey, don't you? And the ones that fall by the wayside are the ones that just never really, come through with the goods. And I think Nick Kyrgios, for me personally, is sort of getting to that point now where it's almost... You have to pull your socks up and get your hands dirty and do some work. Otherwise, he could fall off the face of the planet.
Yeah.
We hear Nick saying, I don't care. I didn't do this. I didn't do that. But do we know that for a fact?
No, I agree.
That's the point. Yeah. Nick is also that type of person that doesn't want to reveal everything he's doing.
Yeah.
He's not going to expose his inner feelings, emotions, thoughts, and all that. He's not the only one who's been in that sort of a situation. You keep that very close to his chest,
And I think even when he responded about the Davis Cup questions, and it was as if he didn't care, of course he cares.
Yeah.
I think the real Nick Kyrgios inside would be going, I just want to go home here. I can't be bothered answering any questions. And
I know for a fact he doesn't like the travel. He does not like being away from home. He pines for the fact to have his mother or his sister or his brother, even his dad, to be out there on the road with him. He struggles. That I know he really struggles with. But he's a professional athlete. He's been in this for a while. You have to care.
That's right. And that's the biggest thing. Because I've travelled around the world and been lonely at times as well. You're away for 6, 7, 8 months of the time. But there's such an opportunity there for him to just go, right, okay, I'm going to do some hard work. I'm going to get the right people around me and then progress forward that way.
Hopefully. Todd Woodbridge was encouraged as well by a few of the comments that he made leading into the tournament about getting those right people around him. Andy Murray.
The sports psychologist aspect.
Yeah. Andy Murray might be a role for him. After
Didn't you see my tweet?
No, I didn't.
Oh,
sorry.
Goodness gracious. At CrossCourt1. when Andy announced the whole retirement aspect and what's going to happen, the tweet I said, I'm putting this out there. Nick said that Andy, when in his tribute
little
to
brother.
Andy, was like a brother.
Yeah.
What about as a coach?
Oh, there you go.
So there you go.
Well, great minds think alike. There we go. let's get to a couple of Aussie wins from yesterday. Alex Bolt, great win against Jack Sock as well.
Yeah.
Because I think for people who don't know, Jack Sock, former...
world top 10.
Yeah, world top 10. Also had gone past John Isner and was number one out of the US for a little while. Mm-hmm. So this is a good victory for Alex.
It is a good victory for Alex. Very good. I'm not downplaying his result. It's excellent. Jack Sock has just fallen off the planet when
what
it comes
has happened?
To... Oh, who knows? I mean, seriously. And he's one of Nick's good friends. He might as well just give up singles at the moment. He's doing incredibly well in doubles, but he's in hoping that that's going to get him back into the singles rhythm. But he has just absolutely fallen off the singles plan. He's way past 100. He needed the USTA wildcard to get into the main draw. Otherwise, he would have been in qualifying.
Yeah.
And for somebody who's a year ago in the top 10 at number 8, won Paris-Bercy, which is a huge tournament, qualified, was I think the last in to qualify for the ATP Finals in 2017. He's just nowhere.
Well, what part of his game is letting him down the most at the moment?
His head, I think.
Yeah. That can be a big problem.
Yeah.
Yeah, massive.
Mental demons.
I'm not a huge Jack Sock fan. I don't really... I mean, obviously, if he's there and he's playing a prominent player, then you need to watch. But... I don't necessarily go out of my way to watch Jack Sock.
Yeah.
We'll get through the winners from the Aussie side of things before we get on to the losers, which there's a lot to talk about too. Alexei Popyrin over Misha Zverev. Alexei, we spoke to a couple of weeks ago on the show and he was really looking forward to the Australian Open. He's into books, Alexei, which we discovered. He's a reader, quite an intelligent young man, and good to see him win over Sasha's older brother.
That is a great result. He got a wild card into the main draw. And Sasha Misha Zverev is a handy player, but that's a big effort. One of Popyrin's good friends is Alex Dimino. The first time I met him, both of them, in fact, was September 2015. They were part of the Junior Davis Cup team that went to Europe. They came through into Glasgow for the Davis Cup semifinals over there just to get to be around the players, get to meet them, see what that experience is all like. So that was the first time I actually met him. He's a tall guy, won Junior French. So... competent. Alex beat him in Sydney last week. Yeah.
So I think bright things ahead for Alexei Popyrin.
Yeah, I mean, it's so good to hear that there's a young player out there that has some other interests outside of the tennis court itself, and to be able to sit down and read. And this is what, when I speak to any really young players, this is the sort of thing I encourage them to do. Find another interest. Go look at museums. Go look at galleries. Pick up some books. Go to the movies. Just build up things around you. Make yourself more rounded. The other person who's a big reader is Stefanos Tsitsipas.
Yeah, we spoke to him a couple of weeks ago.
Big reader. I think one of his favorite books is To Kill a Mockingbird. Great choice.
Covered that one in school, I think. Did you? Kill a Mockingbird.
Yeah, what a book.
That's my favourite book.
It's a really good point, Craig, because being an athlete for a number of years, you can get caught up and it can all consume you. And if you don't have that outside passion, it can eat you up the game.
Especially you guys as well. Cricketers can probably relate to tennis players.
Yeah.
More than most, because you're away for 9 months of the year.
And I think, but the difference also is the cricketers are in a team environment.
Yeah,
these are all individuals. Yeah. They're out there on their own. And this, I go back to the example of Ray Ruffles, former player, turned coach, great guy. When he had Todd Woodbridge and Mark Woodford under his wing, when they were off finishing their training, finished practices, we're in London, we're going to the theatre.
Yep.
We're going to the West End.
So important.
It's so important for the development.
Yeah, interesting. Tsitsipas as well is a big photographer. That was one of the other things he spoke to us about, something a little bit
loves
different.
His photography.
Takes this huge camera everywhere. It's massive. Well, can't even fit it on hand luggage.
That's brilliant. That could pass some time.
He is good.
Yeah.
Beautiful pictures.
Oh, that's good.
Another one of the Aussies yesterday, or we might touch on the girls first of all. Unfortunately for Destiny Aieva, Alia Tomljanovic, Daria Gavrilova and Sam Stosur, they're all knocked out of the tournament. Out of those, who is maybe the the most disappointing. I thought Tom Lanovich had some great opportunities, especially in the... Yeah. I tell you what, if it was the old school tiebreak going to seven, yeah. she was up 6-4, it would have been two match points.
Tell me about it.
Unfortunately, Joanna Konta came out and went bang, and Tom Lanovich finds herself exiting in the first round.
I was disappointed. I really, really wanted her to win. I like her a lot. I'm not a huge Joanna Konta fan. So that was, I was encouraging her even more. But she did have her chances. It was a shame that she didn't sneak that one out. The two, I got to say, that were really disappointing, Daria Gavrilova.
Yes.
She's just not there.
Well, we haven't seen a lot from her, but she was turning to her box and just absolutely giving him a spray, wasn't she?
Yeah, but that's Daria. That's Dasha as well. Yeah, she might be a Russian descent, but she's a good Aussie.
What has happened to Dasha?
Yeah, it's just the mind is just gone. There's no confidence. No confidence. You know, got engaged late last year to Luke Saville.
I hope that hasn't sent her down. Good morning, Luke. Have you listened? It's not your fault.
But just hasn't got it at the moment. I think, you know, whether she needs to take a little bit of a step back, try to chill a bit. She's got the talent. She's got the ability. She's been able to do it. You know, I think it's, as you know, John, this level of sport, everybody can, you know, play backhands and forehands and hit sixes or fours or whatever, it comes down to the head.
Absolutely. That is spot on. That's the difference between the greatest, isn't it? You look at someone like a Roger Federer, and before the tournament he was just like, you know, I've been here, I've done it all, and I know I can navigate my way through certain situations. The mental side of a game like tennis is, geez, that's almost, as you said, that's almost better than a forehand down the line or across court or a gun serve.
Look, I always remember Boris Becker saying, you get to the fifth set of a match in a major, got nothing to do with the backhands and forehands. Yep. Everything to do with the head.
For Daria Gavrilova, what's the next step? You mentioned maybe taking a step back for, you know, a month or so. What should she do now to get herself back into that upper echelon of women's tennis? Because she was never top 10 material, but she, you know, she's someone who could push for a top 20, top 30 ranking.
Well, she's been top 20. She's just, 21 or something like that. So she can do it. And she's quick. Yeah, she's got great strokes, everything. She's got all the technical aspect. Mm. It's just getting the mind into gear all over again. And winning breeds confidence.
Yep.
You know, and that's what you need. You just got to be able to get your mind into focus to be able to do that.
Destiny Aeva, unfortunately, straight sets exit to Madison Keys, although that was half expected against the number 17 seed after Destiny got another wild card this year. Sam Stosur, disappointing.
She had her chances.
Yeah.
Up a break in the first, I think it was.
Yep.
And loses 7-5, 6-2 to Diana Yastremska. Who's a very good young player. I haven't seen her play before. I've heard some good reports about her. And young, starting to make a bit of a breakthrough. But Sam again, what's with momentum, Sam and the Australian Open, you know? It's the whole story again. Look, I went into her post-match yesterday. She was still pretty relaxed. It's Sam.
Yep.
The problem is she's so nice. That is a problem with Sam. And, I said to her, I said, each year with these losses at the Australian, does it escalate the frustration? And she said, no, not really. She said, she hit the ball well. She said she feels good. And feels very encouraged about the year. And she said, it's the first tournament of the year. It's not the end. She said, there's still the whole year to go. So, and then the whole issue of the men's situation with Bernie and Hewitt and all that came up, and she started laughing. She said, maybe they need to watch us. So then I said to her, I said, so, Sam, is there any truth in the rumor that you want to kick out Alicia Molik? She said, what?
Before we get on to what's happening today at the Australian Open, your thoughts on the way things fell yesterday, Leighton Hewitt coming out and basically making it.
Didn't say anything, really.
No.
He didn't say anything. It was almost pointless.
Yeah, it was pointless.
Yeah.
Would he have been better off coming out and doing a press conference rather than a 20-second
interview? That's what we were expecting. We were expecting to, the word was going around that he was going to be doing a press conference. Well, it never happened. And yeah, I think what he said was, what was the point?
So-so,
yeah.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So,
is there anything in that? Is it just, as he said, Bernie being Bernie, or is there just little whispers and, you know?
Look, words have been simmering over the last year, 18 months. Mm. You know, I know that Bernie and Leighton really don't get on. I know that. We all know that for a fact. You know, there's been talk about, well, Nick and Thanasi as well, to a way lesser degree. But it certainly got magnified with Bernie's comments.
Yeah.
A couple of the fixtures coming
up. Sorry. And both guys refused to talk about it.
Yeah.
Nick and Thanasi.
Yeah, in their post-match press conferences. Time to touch base now with Peter Johnston, tournament director of the Kooyong Classic and former Australian tennis player. Pete, good morning.
Morning, Maisie.
How was your view on Nick Kyrgios last night? What did you take out of that one? And is this just about where he's at the moment? Are we always going to see Nick Kyrgios floating around that 20 to 40 mark in the world?
Well, look, I think he was definitely one of the tougher draws, obviously. He hasn't lost first round here before. And Raonic, I thought, was looking as sharp as I've seen him in a couple of years. So it was a really tough matchup. And look, he probably needed the run. I think that was at the end, my end sort of feeling from it. It was just probably, you know, Raonic just a little sharper. And then Nick sort of, he just couldn't find a way in. And Raonic doesn't give you any way in either, really. He's very, it's not a match that you can get rhythm against him, and look, it's tough for Nick now, I think, because he's not going to be ranked 20 or 30 anymore. He's going to be ranked sort of 60 or 70, and that's going to make it a bit of a rebuild time for him, and has to play probably more matches now because he's not going to get buys in some main draws. He's going to have to even play some qualies in some of the bigger events. And so I think, you know, it's sort of a reset time for him at the moment.
In that regard, is this where his career is at in terms of a crossroad? Is this the time where we'll either find out whether Nick Kyrgios wants to be a top 20 player or not?
I don't know so much about a crossroad. I think it's more every player has to deal with it when your ranking drops and or when you're defending a lot of points from the previous year. It's definitely a position that he hasn't been in for a while, though, so he has to, you know, I guess take the medicine of being ranked a little lower and just grind it out to some degree. I felt like he was in really good frame of mind in terms of how he's been handling the media and handling sort of the appearances and everything so far this summer, and I think it's been sort of a bit sad that he hasn't put them on the court as much as I'm sure he'd like, because I think he was fairly, almost a bit serene. I know last night he's angry with himself, and but in a relative sense, I think he sort of handled the spotlight well over January, and now he's really got to probably, you know, get away, play a lot of tournaments where you have to grind it out.
And is it just that simple, Peter, for Nick now, is just moving forward, is just playing all those tournaments, getting his body right, probably first and foremost, but that's really what he needs to do now, is just play a lot around the world and work hard, surely.
Yeah, I think it's sort of as simple and as difficult as that.
Yeah.
I think, you know, that's actually, it's really tough. And look, you see other guys, look at, say, Stan Wawrinka going through it, you know, which was due to injury, and Murray due to injury, but when your ranking drops, that's the system. You've got to work. You've got to. You're not picking up quite the guarantees that you were getting money wise. You know, like Nick is big in the box office anywhere he plays, and but when you rank that little bit lower, then the tournament's got a little more bargaining power, or you know sometimes he might even need a wild card, and so it's just a whole different mindset. But look, I think I feel like he's certainly going to be able to handle it. It's just that you have to, you know, suck it up a little bit and go for it.
What have you made of the whole situation surrounding Bernard Tomic's comments and also the responses, which were basically no responses from Leighton Hewitt and also Kokkinakis and Kyrgios when they were asked about it? What do Tennis Australia need to do, or do they not need to do anything? Can they let this one sort of just play out and get on with life?
Well, there's a lot of experts. aspects to it, Maisie, isn't there, really? And it's been played out a lot. I mean, the way I see it, you've got Davis Cup is sort of a segment within the overall Tennis Australia. It's a team. It's managed by Leighton, and it's like a footy team, you know. And so he runs that team with the support of Tennis Australia and Davis Cup, but it's only a small component of the whole tennis year. And in fact, it's going through a lot of change. And so the you know, there's a lot of people who question the relevance of it these days. I think that's the Davis Cup piece, which is where Bernie was sort of giving some opinions on should Leighton play doubles or not. They're all just his opinions, which I think he's totally entitled to. I think then, though, you've got the broader situation of Tennis Australia, and it's to me, Tennis Australia should be a broad church, fostering every player, adding value to every player, if you like. Not like no one's out, everyone's in. You don't have to. I don't mean by writing out big checks, but just sort of that's your family, and you sort of got to manage the family as best you can, and also at the same time acknowledging that players are individuals, and they're not necessarily beholden to you. But I think, you know, I feel like it's got a little bit blurred between this Davis Cup issue and the broader tennis issue. And, you know, I think the other part of it is, look, Bernie doesn't like doing media, and so he's not one to call his own press conferences or anything like this. So the time to get him is once he's played his matches. And I felt really disappointed that a lot of people were construing his comments as being like a sook sour grapes from losing to Cilic. He actually gave Cilic a lot of credit in the match and had the utmost respect for him. He actually, even in the press conference, had respect for Leighton because he said what a great champion he was and so forth. Like, so, I feel like there's been a bit of blur. It's easy for people to jump to, oh, Tomic's at it again, but I think there's some layers within it that needs some more consideration before anyone forming any views.
It's a pleasure about this time every year to catch up with the voice of cycling, Phil Liggett, who's over at the Tour Down Under, and he joins us again on this Wednesday morning. Phil, good morning, and welcome back to RSN 927.
Lovely to speak to you again.
Nice and warm in Adelaide this time of year. Tell us about a few of the stage reductions over the first couple of days of the Tour Down Under. And how hot has it been? 41 we're hearing again today.
Yes, they're talking at the same. We were seeing on the motorbikes following the rise yesterday, temperatures hitting 45 on their thermometers. But it was a hot one. The riders had a good chase after three or four guys for a while, and then in the end brought them all together about 40K from the finish. Then there was common sense rain. They slowed right down to 30, 35K an hour, took on water, and then they got their heads down for the finish in Port Adelaide. And in all honesty, I've not heard any complaints from the riders, but they did cut the distance down only by 3 kilometres yesterday. But today they've knocked 30 kilometres off the route. And so we miss out our little sort of triangle trip off the route to Williamstown. And instead, we go straight to the finish in Anguston.
How different are the off seasons for cyclists and their preparation for the season ahead? Because obviously, we've got the European summer, which is the goal of a lot of these cyclists later in the year. But what do they do in the off season? Do they go heat training? Do they go to altitude and do training amongst the snow? What do cyclists normally do?
Well, in the old days, they actually went skiing.
Yep.
We're going back 20 years or more. They used to have their own cycling skiing championships up in the Alps or the Pyrenees, and they kept fit that way because you're using very similar muscles in skiing as you do in cycling. But these days, and then really it's partly due to the advent of the Tour Down Under, which started 21 years ago, and European cyclists suddenly had to readjust their way of living because they would come from the snows and be expected to show why they're so good in the month of January in a hot Australian summer. So they, in fact, the sport has become totally worldwide now. South Africa has become a player in the Games, for example. Last year we had a King of the Mountains here with Nicholas Lamini, who's riding again. He's from Cape Town, where this weather's the same as it is in Cape Town at this time of the year. So they do their training camps in sunnier climes, and they've had to realise that they can't stay fit for 10 months. So they'll train up for the events they want to win. Some will have targeted this race. Then they'll go downhill a little bit for a few weeks, and then they'll train themselves back up for the one-day classics in Europe or the upcoming Tour of Italy or Tour de France. So it's a 12-month season now.
Phil, you've been covering cycling for a very long time, and this is the 20th year of the Tour Down Under. It's hard to believe that. But how do we stack up, us little old Aussies, in terms of the grand scheme of things in world cycling?
Well, the Aussies are amongst the top ranks now, particularly on the velodromes, of course. They're in amongst the medals at the Olympic Games there because they're very good. It's usually a British-Australian battle in the Olympic Games, for example. But on the road race, they've had these marvellous moments now. People like Stuart O'Grady and Matthew Hayman winning the great one-day classic, Paris-Roubaix. Simon Gerrans, who retired at the end of last year, he won this race four times, and he's also won the big classics like the Liège-Bastogne-Liège and Milan-San Remo. The Aussies are right up there. They're feared. I was talking to a European two or three weeks ago, and they used to talk about English-speaking cyclists as cannon fodder. Now they are 100% respected. They really are. If they watch them come through the training regimes that they've got going, they work. And, of course, we've now won the Tour de France. I say we. Australia's won the Tour de France with Adele.
Yes.
We've won the Tour de France in Great Britain with three different riders now. I know it's a whole different ball game over those years of the Tour Down Under.
Phil, always a pleasure to speak to you on RSN 927. Thanks so much for your time again this morning. We look forward to seeing your coverage over the next few days at the Tour Down Under.
Look forward to it. Thanks, guys.
Roglic with time. Oh, that will send Australia to the knockout phase as Group B runners up. It is as sweet a hit as you can wish to see from Tommy Roglic, and Australia lead for the third time in this game. And that is probably now the final say. Great goal.
Oh, a bit of relief in my household at about 2 a.m. this morning when Roglic hit the back of the net. Australia through 3-2 over Syria, the final group game of their Asian Cup campaign. Now on to the knockout stages. And to tell us all about that and what to expect from the knockout stages, Craig Foster has joined us on the line, football analyst from SBS. Craig, good morning and thanks for your time on RSN 927.
No, good morning, guys. It's a pleasure to be with you. Yeah, but we're all a little bit groggy this morning. It was a very, very late night.
Yes. It was indeed, yes. Those, the 12:50 a.m. kickoff is a lot harder to deal with than the family-friendly 10 p.m.
yes.
kickoff that you
can, it really is, yeah.
you can go to bed nice and early from. What did you make of the performance? 3-2, they get through the Socceroos, but still a few questions lingering over there. Consistency within games, I think.
I think that's right, yes, and... Look, there's many positives, of course. You know, they led three times. I think they did show themselves superior to Syria. And don't forget, this was a team that we struggled against, and we needed Timmy to really save us in World Cup qualification. So it was a powerful statement as a win. Roglic coming back to, I thought, near his best was also extremely positive. Particularly when he pulls out wide onto the right-hand side, you've seen now cross into McLaren, where he's multiple times, where he's almost scored. You've seen plenty of passes from that side as well. And again, it's come from that side of the field, this time with a beautiful strike. Conor Meadies is the breakout player for Australia, and let's hope for the tournament, as Massimo Luongo was back in 2015 at home when Ange did such a fabulous job. And here you've got a Chris really growing. You know, that's one of the big positives. It's not just that he's doing well, but he's doing better every game. He's growing in confidence. He's got this confidence to take anyone on. He goes at players. He creates things. And to duck in at the post, he showed his goal-scoring awareness, his speed, and his skill to get into the back post for that first goal. So... that's the positive. So I think on the other side, we are still up and down. I like the general direction, and I'm a big supporter of it. I think, in general, Graham's doing really well. Mm-hmm. But what really worried me last night, I think we missed Mark Milligan in midfield, actually, which is an issue, because he controlled the game against Palestine extremely well. Different level. Palestine, I don't think, are quite Syria. But he even in the first game against Jordan, where we didn't get the points, I thought he controlled the game really well there. He stops counter-attacks well, but his distribution is really excellent. And without someone there of his experience, I thought, and obviously Irvine and Massimo are great players, but their experience, without him there, it just became a game that was up and down. It was a bit more like Jordan.
Yep.
We didn't have control. We couldn't sit in their half. I thought we were a bit impatient, and by trying to go forward and score every time we had the ball, we stretched ourselves and let them come back at us. And therefore, it just made it that type of game. It's like, you know, we're up and half a chance, and all of a sudden they're back in our end having a corner or a free kick, and then we're up again. Whereas that's really what you want to avoid. You want to make sure that you have complete control of these opponents, and that I think a lot of that was due to Millsy being out of that midfield.
Yeah, well, hopefully he's back in there with the return of Trent Sainsbury for the knockout stages. One man I wanted to talk about was Owen Mabil. A fantastic story, first of all, getting into the Socceroos, and even just his personal story behind that as well. But what a curling shot that was, with his opposite foot to his left, to open proceedings, and he's really entrenching himself in this Socceroos starting 11 as a must-pick.
Well, he is a must-pick now. Is that 4-7, did I hear last night on the coverage?
Yeah.
Wow. I mean, that's as good a start as any Socceroo I can remember. I'd have to go to the stats, and Andrew Howe, our stato, would be on top of that. I'll check that this morning. But, I mean, you guys have got me up early, right? So I'm going a bit blind in that respect. But, mate, it's just been a magnificent start from him. That's credit to Graham Arnold as well. He's pulled him up. He's put him in. He's had faith in him. You know, even across those games, you could see a little bit of inexperience, you know, bring in performance and then not so, kept faith with him. Maybe a few of the injuries have worked to Awa's favour, and he's taken advantage of it. And now he's an absolute guarantee spot. I mean, that is a beautiful piece of work. It was a lovely run by Ryan Grant. And he's done really well. I thought he was pretty exceptional last night, because everything, particularly in the second half, was coming down our right-hand side. They seemed to be trying to block our left. I'm not sure why. But, you know, the ball would just go from the keeper out, two, three passes, and then straight out to Ryan. And I thought he did well there. His run inside, his underlap, as we call it, was great. But normally doing that, Awer would check outside. And when he checked inside, I thought, oh, geez, what are you doing? There's no space there. That's, you know, he's made the run through there, Awer. What are you doing? And, of course, and that's the beauty of the game, right? That's the beauty of, you know, champion athletes. They break the rules.
Yeah,
they break the rules and they pull something out of nothing. And then you go, well, mate, you're not supposed to be doing that. Like, the reason he's made that run is for this purpose. But because you're just a brilliant, creative player, you've checked inside and you've just decided, well, I'm going to just curl a magnificent left footer into that far corner. It was just a beautiful piece of work.
So, Craig, now a few days off, I'd imagine, for the Socceroos to get right. Who does it look like at this stage we're going to be playing, either Japan or Uzbekistan?
That's right. Yeah, exactly. So that's what I'm reading. That's what I'm reading this morning. So I guess that'll develop as we go through the day or the next couple of days, but that's a big difference.
Yeah, you know? So I suppose that's, we're all barracking for Japan to finish
Well, you know, it'd be nice. I mean, you know, we like to say we've got to take everyone on, fine, but, you know, come on, in the final it'd be nice. And the other thing is, because this team's still developing, you know, we talked, one of the things that hasn't been mentioned a lot, I think, is around the World Cup last year and the fact that we took Bert van Marwijk there. You know, really experienced, been in a World Cup final before and all that stuff. But it wasn't an appointment I supported, and we all have our own opinions, which is the beautiful part of sport. But I just thought it was a great opportunity to give Graham what Ange had, that is, a World Cup prior to an Asian Cup. And that was a big factor in what happened in 2015. So because that decision wasn't made, and, you know, we're in a situation here where this is his first tournament, and so we're sort of going back to the 2014 World Cup, right, where first tournament, you're trying to build through the tournament, you're trying to work out who's going to really step up here. You know, he's got big leaders out, he's trying to fill a leadership vacuum. Millsy's trying to grow as captain as well, and I think we saw him do that in the second game against Palestine, which the guys on Fox identified really well at halftime. Might have been Andy Harper. He said, listen, this guy has had a captain's performance there, and watching, I thought, yeah, that's good. Graham's encouraged him, look, you're the man now. I mean, you have to take control of this team. And he's certainly grown into that. But it just goes to show that this is a process. And we really want to, if possible, you know, hit our greatest rivals historically and in terms of ranking, you know, as late in the tournament as possible. So I'm certainly hoping for Uzbekistan. And that would be another step, another difficult one, but another bit of growth. We certainly, I'm sure, would put on a better performance than this morning and keep growing.
Craig, thanks so much for your time this morning on RSN 927. Okay. It's been great talking to you, and thanks for setting that alarm to get up.
No, pleasure, guys, pleasure.
Manus Labuschagne has joined us before the Cricket Australia 11 take on Sri Lanka tomorrow in Hobart, a day-night, three-day game, so very much looking forward to following that over the next few days. Manus, good morning and welcome to the show.
How are you guys going?
We're going very well. How are you after the call-up for Sydney and now back with the Cricket Australia 11 before hopefully another couple of test matches this summer?
Yeah, you know, obviously it's a great privilege, and it was a very exciting week a couple of weeks ago, obviously playing the Sydney test. And it's a bit of a whirlwind, but it's great to sort of, get another opportunity this week for the CA 11, and then, hopefully, you know, whatever happens with selection in the test match.
Manus, paint a bit of a picture for us and all our listeners and what it's like in the Australian setup at the moment. Obviously, there's a lot of pressure involved and there's a lot of things happening externally, but what's it like internally?
Yeah, internally it's actually going really well. It's, you know, the environment's nice. We're nice and relaxed. We're getting, you know, guys are getting more comfortable in that environment. There's a few guys getting some more experience. The older guys in the group are really, you know, sort of leading the way in terms of the off-field and what's happening behind the scenes.
Did you feel more comfortable at test level this time around in Sydney? Obviously, your first test in Australia, but you look really good at the crease and organised, and you're a bit unlucky, really, not to go on with the start you had. How did you feel with the home test in Australia?
It was awesome. Like I said, getting the privilege to end up going out at number three was awesome. And it was probably a little bit of a comfort zone thing as well, because obviously I bat three for Queensland. Going out at number three, it was sort of, I didn't have to sit there and wait to get my opportunity and think about it a lot. So I was out there quite early. Once you're out there, it's just sort of, all the noise just becomes just nothing, just becomes quiet noise, and then you just kind of react and play.
Manus, what are you looking to get out of a week like this leading into the CA 11 game? It can be quite hard at times. Obviously, there's four of you in there that are sort of jostling for positions, and I mean, that can be hard at times. I've been in that situation as well, but what are you looking to get out of this week?
Oh, look, personally, you know, spending time in the middle is the key. It doesn't matter, you know, what game it is. And, every game that we play is important. There's people watching. So you want to just make sure, you prepare exactly like you would if it was a test match or a first-class game. And just make sure that, obviously, you know, conditions are slightly different. It's a day-night game. So, just make sure you're ready and relaxed and ready to perform. I think that's the key. I think if you can never say, I'm not going to, you know, you're just going to have to give it your best and make sure you prepare like you would for any other game.
And not run out your partner if they start to get on about 50 or 60 if they're looking to get a big one.
Yeah,
Manus, tell us about bowling with the pink ball. We know that you bowled some really handy spin over in the UAE, and then also with in Sydney as well. Is there any change when you move to the pink ball? We know there is for the seam bowls, but what about the spinners?
Slightly. I think the conditions in Hobart is, especially first innings when we played there a couple of weeks ago, is definitely favourable for the seam bowler. And so spinners come into it on sort of day three, you know, towards the back end. I don't think it really changes much with the pink ball. In terms of the actual bowling side of things, no, I don't think it changes anything. I think it's just a different colour ball.
That was what we did yesterday on Summer Breakfast. We will be back shortly after the news with John Bowden.